case this morning, Patel versus Holder.
Your Honor, Professor Banasari, on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Bhavesh Patel. May I please the Court, Your Honor? Your Honor, we are seeking the answer to two questions. One is whether unfulfilled threats, which were in the categories of past experience, are indication of a danger of future persecution. Whether the petitioner's religious caste and belief and past experience of receiving serious threat that he experienced exposed him to be a member of a special social and religious group which falls in the category of real act, which he needs to be protected.
But the problem, I think, with your position is that, you know, I certainly understand that once you put him in the position of being a witness to this violence committed by, allegedly, the five Hindus burning the Muslim man, as a Hindu, he's in a very difficult position because he either has to rat out his fellow Hindus or he has to let pass a terrible act of violence against a Muslim. But you can't really say, as a Hindu, he's subject to persecution in India. Hindus are the dominant religious group in India. And it's really the intersection of his status as Hindu with his status as a witness to this violence in Gujarat that does this. So the problem I'm having with your theory is how one looks at this, because I think you're really talking about him as a Hindu who is a material witness to Hindu-on-Muslim violence. That's a much smaller group, and I'm not even sure that is a group, to be honest.
In addition to that, Your Honor, you are correct. In addition to that, he's in that particular group, not a lot of Hindus, they are against violence against Muslim by non-Muslim, particularly Hindus, but he is in that particular limited social group.
If it is a social group, I mean, and yet, look at what you're saying. I mean, to the extent the government is actually trying to prosecute these cases, and there have been lots of books and articles and all sorts of things written about Gujarat over the years, particularly after 2002, and I note that his experience was before the terrible riots of 2002.
That train.
But, you know, the government's trying to go after some of this. If we decided to give asylum to people just to avoid being called to testify as witnesses, how can we do that? How can we assume that the government of India wouldn't protect its own witnesses?
Your Honor, also the reports, possibly you have seen credible report by U.S. Department and State Department, which clearly shows that they are unable to provide adequate protection to the people like my client who was a witness, if he is appeared in court and testify.
I'm not sure the reports are that. What particular part of those reports are you relying on? The government has put into the record the 2005 International Religious Freedom Report, 2005 Report of Human Rights Practices.
You know,
in the court setting, I understand the government has not been fully successful in damping down all Hindu-Muslim, Muslim-Hindu violence, but in a court setting, what shows this?
You know, we are really looking at the general issues, which is between Muslim and Hindus. If the government was able to provide adequate protection, this riots and this incident would not occur repeatedly.
Well, maybe not, but I mean, I thought your particular theory was if he were to go back to India and there was no call upon him to testify in this case, I didn't think you had any argument about that. I thought you were focusing on the fact that he might be called as a witness, that he still thinks he will be called as a witness.
Correct.
So I don't see how we can consider this case without the court aspect, and I just don't see where in these government reports it says that group of people are in particular ignored by the government.
Your Honor, at this time, I don't have a particular incident to bring to court attention saying that on such and such an individual, similarly situated with my client appeared and testified, and he was subsequently harmed. But basically what is going on is the strong indication that he will be harmed, and the government is not in a position to provide him adequate protection. You know, I wanted to go briefly to the facts of the case, but it seems, Your Honor, that you know the facts of the case. We just refers to or bring to the attention of the court a few decisions of this honorable court, which they have said that unfulfilled threats are considered as the threats can constitute past persecution in the most extreme circumstances. For instance, where there are a most immediate or menacing nature, or if the perpetrator attempts to follow through on the threats. We are directing the attention to Biko versus Gonzalez, 468 F the 3rd, page 482, and 2006 decision. We believe, Your Honor, here the perpetrator of the threats which made against Mr. Patel, they are in a position to fulfill that threat against him. And we again, as I indicated earlier, the government of India is not in a position to control these numerous groups that they are seriously committed to following on that threat against Mr. Patel. Again, also, the court, also in another matter, in matter of Biko, again, it states that unfulfilled threats may be indication of future persecution. Again, we are believing that the BIA and the immigration judge erred when they denied that the fact, Mr. Patel's application for withholding of relief, because Mr. Patel clearly falls within one of the categories mentioned at the Real Act. He's based, his threat and his fear of returning back to India is based on his membership in that particular social and religious group. It's not because of his fear of testifying before a criminal tribunal. And the immigration judge and also the BIA confirmed the fact that he remotely maybe his religious belief, but we believe it's vice versa. It's his religious belief and falling in that particular social group is the main reason. And we believe that if the court solved these issues, then Mr. Patel should be granted his application for withholding and relief under the Convention Against Torture. Regarding the Convention Torture, Mr. Patel credibly established that he was more likely than not to be harmed and tortured if he returns to India at the acquiescence of the Indian authorities. Although he is not going to be tortured by the Indian authorities, but again, the Indian authorities are aware of his threat and they are not in a position to provide him adequate protection. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel? Sit at the counsel table.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ann Wellhoff for Respondent, United States Attorney General Holder. May it please the Court. Your Honor, the issue in this case is whether the decision of the Board is grounded in substantial evidence. And this Court's very familiar with that standard of review. It's highly deferential, requires that the petitioner point to evidence in the record that not only supports his position, but compels his position. Petitioner has failed to do so in this case. And
now, Ms. Wellhoff, the problem that I have with the government's argument in this case is that I think it's trying to make this a simpler case than it really is. In fact, Mr. Patel's identity as a Hindu has everything to do with the fear that he faces. I'm sure you know you're aware of the history of violence between the Hindus and the Muslims in the state of Gujarat in India. It's truly horrific, and there again, have been lots of books written about it, particularly in India, even some here. And it's a little bit like, you know, the Muslims who are guilty of apostasy. I mean, he is a Hindu if he actually supports in court publicly the account of Hindu violence against Muslim. It's not like you or me or somebody completely unrelated to it coming in. It is really because he's a Hindu. Now, I also see on the other side that it's not every Hindu who's going to face this. And so in that sense, it's not merely his Hindu identity that's a problem. It's the intersection, as I said, also to Mr. Bani Asadi. What I feel, the board has not really explained how these two things intersect and how we ought to take into account the intersection of those two.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would clarify that this is not a social group case. There's been some discussion in the opening about that. At no time was petitioner arguing he was a member of a social group. He interchangeably threw in his argument to the board and the brief here with this court, particular religious group. I think that's sort of a mixing of the terms. The board did not do a social group analysis, and we really are only looking at religion. So.
Okay, and again, we can be that way about it if we want to. We can call both Hindu and Muslim religions, but it's a comprehensive word. It's like calling somebody Jewish, and, you know, yes, you might be talking about their religion, you might be talking about their ethnicity, you might be talking about a lot of things. So fine, we can I don't think there's any waiver. He's talking about the Hindu and the Muslim identities, his own Hindu identity in the intersection, and the way it factors into his presumptively required testimony in this very delicate prosecution.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you made an excellent point in opening and basically suggested that, but for his having witnessed this crime and the fact that he's being subpoenaed by the government under its lawful authority, he has alleged no harm. And I think that this case is really an utter lack of proof. As the court goes back and reviews the administrative record and reads the testimony, at no time did the petitioner, and that is the only evidence, by the way, is the testimony of petitioner, at no time did he make any statements that would even suggest that the reason either of these two groups are after him, Hindus or Muslims, is because of his practice of his Hindu religion. It is all, by his own words, because he witnessed this crime.
Right, and because he's a Hindu who witnessed this crime. Now, you may have a very strong argument if you then go to the next step and say, where is his evidence of threats? Where is his evidence that the government, in fact, will not protect witnesses who appear pursuant to lawful subpoenas? Where, you know, there we have a lot of cases, as he has alluded to, about that. But I think if he had been, you know, a Christian or a Sikh or something else and had witnessed the same crime, his position would be quite different. It's hard to be over simplistic about this.
Well, certainly his allegations are that he faces potential harm from two groups, the Hindus and the Muslims.
Because he is Hindu. As a Hindu, they will retaliate against him for helping out the Muslims.
But perhaps so, but the motive of the perpetrators is retaliatory. It's not to persecute him for the practice of his Hindu religion.
It's because he's Hindu, though, right?
No, the Hindu.
Because his identity is Hindu, well, which is maybe a religious identity or whatever.
Well, again, the evidence in this case is that his own members of his own faith are seeking his loyalty. They're not persecuting him because of his practice of his religion. They are, if his alleged fear, that is, there has been no past persecution, but his fear all stems from his possible disloyalty to the Hindus, that's not persecution. He's still free to be a Hindu. They want him to be a Hindu. They want him to be a loyal Hindu. There's no persecution from the Hindus.
He claims they're going to kill him if he testifies for the Muslims.
Your Honor, if you read the testimony, I see that in the brief. I didn't find a specific threat of killing, although I could be wrong. I did not find one. There was some threats. But again, as Petitioner's Counsel pointed out, in order for those to be evidence of persecution, first of all, they need to be immediate, menacing, and there must be actual efforts towards furthering those threats. There's no evidence of that in this case. Again, as to the Muslims, on the other hand, are they persecuting him for his religion? Well, again, the evidence, I think, if you read the testimony, is that they are after him for one reason alone, because he was a witness. If he had been a Christian or some other religion and witnessed this, I would submit that, again, the evidence doesn't show the only reason that they're after him is because he's a Hindu. It's because he witnessed this crime. So I believe that substantial...
He's a witness and incidentally a Hindu, as opposed to the other way around.
Your Honor?
I said that he's a witness and incidentally a Hindu.
That's what the evidence shows.
That he's a Hindu and incidentally a witness.
We would submit that the evidence demonstrates that, or certainly substantial evidence supports that.
I thought
conclusion.
That was your position.
Pardon me?
I assume that was your position.
It is, because that is what the evidence shows in this case. Additionally, there's no evidence in this record that the police who are subpoenaing him are even aware that he's receiving threats. There's absolutely no evidence of that in this case. So we can't really bring in governmental conduct without that evidence as well. And so, again, that finding by the board is grounded in substantial evidence. I believe my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. How much time? About 2 minutes.
Your Honor, again, the governor failed to address the issue of unfulfilled threats to my clients, and as I indicated, two cases this court previously has considered those unfulfilled threats, if they are really the perpetrator in a position to implicate to fulfill with the threats are considered past persecution. The government failed even to address that issue. Regarding the furthering of the threats, the Hindus and the Muslim both, they visited Mr. Patel's home after he left. Even they are asking him to come and to cooperate. Therefore, they are furthering on their threat as we are standing. So there is no evidence the government showed that Mr. Patel is immune if he returns home. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.